when he was, no, yesterday, when he was talking, was really, really nervous and disturbed, and he knew that his end is close. So, you're right, Dr. Freud. There are plenty of questions that are not answered yet. Back to you.
AC2GS. Yeah, I think that's the ultimate thing. There's a lot of questions, very few answers. I don't really like the answers that people are giving. They sound fudged. I don't think that Voroshin didn't want to harm any Russians. The man is the butcher of Bakhmut. He had his soldiers shoot Russians if they were going in the opposite direction away from the front. The guy is a sociopath. I don't think he cared if he killed half of Moscow. I don't know what stopped him, and I don't know why Lukashenko was able to figure out a way around this. The man is not the most clever person in the world. None of this makes sense. It's like someone just made up all of these facts temporarily, and eventually someone will actually tell the world what the heck really happened. Finally, Ed.
I've been following this closely, and I've seen a number of very, very knowledgeable people about this sort of stuff interviewed. And what sticks out to me is the more informed, the more knowledgeable, the better their credentials, the more baffled they are.
And I think that's smart on their part. It kind of goes back to the old concept that the more you learn about the subject, the more you realize you don't know anything about the subject. I think people who just make believe they know what's going on are able to portray brilliance easier than people who are really involved in all of this. It just does not make any sense is the problem.
Dr. Roy, do you remember Robin Hood's story?
Yes, steal from the rich and give to the poor.
Yes, so Prigozhin is portrayed to the public as the Robin Hood. You know, 40 billion, billion requested by, I mean, confiscated by 2 days ago by FSB, which is like something like a special forces. Russian special forces. But go with his 25,000 army to any bank and just take the money back. So he was his army in Rostov on the Don, when the command center of the Russian army is. People were happy that they see them. People were paying in the restaurants for them. People were giving them flowers. He was a Robin Hood, and of a sudden, everything ended. Enter here.
What is that?
Ed, recognize 1 second. Let me see if I have the repeater. Okay. The FSB is just a rebranded KGB. Putin was a colonel, I think, in the KGB, and so it got rebranded to FSB. So it's just a Mark II of the KGB. And I don't think he gave to the poor. I think it was enemy of my enemy is my friend. I think the average Russian didn't trust the military establishment. They are sort of known to be a bunch of drunks and stealing most of the budget and using it to bankroll their own lives. And so there's a lot of, and it's, you know, even though they kept it kind of quiet that they were losing this war, I think a lot of people know that they were losing this war, and a lot of people were returning back in a somewhat dead condition. So I think it's more that he developed fame for what he did, unfortunately, in Bakhmut, and he's just not the guy who's running the military so badly. So I think that's more important to them than if they think he's going to give them any money. That was kind of the operative thing for Robin Hood, that he gave poor people money. I don't really see Ferozian giving anyone any money unless it's to his own benefit.
I agree with you. But people saw in him somebody like a Robin Hood, somebody like a person who's going to make a change. 226,000 Russians died unless on the Ukrainian soil till now. I believe in all Afghan war, Russian lost about 10,000 people. So now we have 226,000. And how many wanted? We don't know. So we're talking about 1 million of young Russians who decided to flee Russia because they were asked to go to the forces. They didn't want to fight for somebody's war. And that somebody's war is one person's war. Although we don't want to talk politics but the history, we may say that from historical perspective, everything is sick there. So that will be probably that what I can say. You can make the end summary of that, and let's go to the underwater subject. Back to you, Dr. Roy.
Okay, I'm going to ask Ed what he was trying to say. It was a little noisy when I heard him. I just want to give my 2 cents. Unfortunately, Russia has been ruled by tyrants going back 400 years. Unfortunately, I think a lot of its citizens are used to it and prefer it. A strong man seems to be the guy who runs that country for hundreds and hundreds of years. Different people, but the same old nonsense. And Russia has fought wars the same exact way. They use their citizens, unfortunately, like ammunition. They just throw them into the fight, and there's always more where that's coming. I feel bad for Russian citizens. They don't deserve this, but they seem to keep falling into the same hole. So I don't know what the answer is. Ed, you want to close this off with your comment?
Yeah, first, I just made a comment about where Ferozian was supposed to be Robin Hood, and I said, I didn't know Robin Hood had a stash of money somewhere. I didn't really, if there really was a Robin Hood, he didn't do things. I don't think there really was, but that's another story. Yeah, I do have a point. You alluded to it. Actually, Wesley alluded to it. All the best drivers in Russia, the 30-year-olds, they all ran like hell because they could afford to get out of there before they were turned into World War I style cannon fodder. Right?
Yeah, I agree with you. They're suffering a brain drain. They have been for the last 30 years. You know, some of the smartest researchers in the United States have a Russian surname. There's a reason for that. But that's the nature of things. You know, again, the best and the brightest are running for the hills. They're trying to make it more and more difficult. Other than the short term of having as much money as you could possibly count, you know, when Elon Musk runs around as the richest man in the world, I am willing to bet you anything that if we knew how much Putin had, he would have much more than Musk would ever dream of having. So for the sake of being the secret richest guy in the world, he is willing to burn Russia down. And that's the nature of strongmen. They never do it for love of country, although they'll use that as an excuse. They do it for love of themselves.
Wonder who's the richest person in the world?
Who?
the person who gets an overflow standing room only crowd at his funeral. Unfortunately, then it's too late.
Yeah, I would say that's the most successful human being in the world, not necessarily the richest person in the world, because unfortunately we have currency and units of value, and everyone compares them with each other, and there's way too many people with severe psychiatric problems that their greed knows no limitation. After the first $1 billion, what's the point? Well, the point is the next billion and the next billion and the next billion and the next billion, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
All that matters is the definition of the word rich. Remember, just about every small airplane has a control entitled rich. As in how much gasoline and how much air does the crop already get. But it doesn't mean you put more money in the bank account when you turn up the rich control.
I guess so, but, if you talk to the average person, rich means money, and we've all kind of interacted with people. My father, may rest in peace, I remember at one point I disagreed with someone in the newspaper, and my father's strange response was, this guy is worth $100 million. How could you say he's wrong and you're right? You're not worth $100 million.
I have comments about that.
Certainly.
I have here. I told my kids this story, and they're both better educated than I am. They're very smart, they're very practical, but they haven't disagreed with me. Money is the most important thing in the world until you have food on the table and a roof over your head. After that, if something is about a value judgment, don't sell yourself out for money. You already have all the food and rules.
Well, philosophically, I agree with you 100%. I do, unfortunately, know there are those psychiatric problems out there where they need to reinforce their value, and this is how they chose to do it. By their net worth, that they read in Fortune 500 articles and such, there's a diminishing return to having wealth. There's a certain point where extra wealth above that point becomes more of a nuisance than a benefit. As I've repeatedly told people, you can't buy love, but you certainly can rent it. So there are people who are more interested in leasing love in the short term. So for those people, I guess having more money, you could lease better love. I don't know. It's a weird, weird world. We all have to kind of figure out for ourselves what we want and hopefully attempt successfully to get what we want. And if one of our members was around, he would say, well, you've got to know what you need, not what you want. But anyway... let's just jump on this submersible just for a few minutes because I don't want to take too much time away from Paul. Any closing comments before we quickly jump to submersible bed?
If you jump on the submersible, that will not go well. You might want to stay far away from it.
No, let's go underwater.
Well, I certainly don't want to go underwater with that. Recently, everyone noticed you couldn't hide under a rock enough to miss it. The submersible, and everyone learned what a submersible versus a submarine. Submarines go underwater, and they're self-contained underwater vehicles. Submersibles go underwater, but they need to be attached to another vessel. The submersible Titan, which was a tourist trap to see the Titanic wreckage, was destroyed in one of its tourist trips. And a lot of people came out and said that the owner, designer, and the guy running the show died of hubris, that the man was an arrogant so-and-so. And there's a whole slew of emails of very smart people telling him, for God's sake, don't use that submersible. And he would just say, hey, you bunch of wussies. and say that he knew better until he didn't. So Ed, if you have any comments about it, I'd love to hear.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I love figuring out these things. And remember, I know people involved in submarine pebbles. And here's the thing. The first thing is the head guy, the one who everybody's doing. He says, have to integrate. You cannot stay. And to a point, I agree with him 100%. You have to innovate. Every change in history has been risky. But when he and I go our separate ways, you'll just blindly go ahead and put your life on the line. I am currently involved in a project that I think has gone out too far at the sea and it's going to blow up in their face. But they'll be stuck with a high failure rate. All right, you know, people call you up and say, hey, crap don't work, I want a new one. That's very different than putting your and other people's lives at risk. And what he did, he could put lives at risk for something without fully analyzing, evaluating, and exhaustively testing his design. What do to break the logjam? You can come up with an off-the-wall idea, put it up to peer review, some spitballing, and then you build a proof of concept that you play with it, you see what it takes to break it, and if things look good, you keep moving up. But it's a long, slow, expensive process. Okay, so far, Roy?
Yes, yes.
I mean, look at the Navy submarine. You know, in, 120-odd years, they've come tremendous difference, you know, tremendous stuff. Hundreds, thousands of outrageous ideas that were evaluated, you know, going at the wall to see what it did. They would try, evaluate, test it, do some more testing. So, that is the way it works. But what this guy did, he short-circuited the whole thing. He ignored the evaluation. Now, when I first heard about this, I said, it sounds to me like metal fatigue catastrophic failure. Apparently it went down for like 7,000 feet. Everything hunky-dory. The last communication was perfectly normal. Then nothing. Then either they had a communication failure, in which case, one way or another, it was resolved in a matter of hours. Or I said, they've had a catastrophic collapse of the pressure hull. And I mean, I'm thinking, this sucker's been going up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. That sounds to me like metal fatigue. You know, car radiators do have a lifetime with the roads heating up, standing, cooling down for cranking, heating up and standing, cooling down for cranking. Eventually, a car radiator will start to leak from metal fatigue. More probably see it if we kept ours long enough. So, that was my initial thing. But then I found out it's all carbon fiber. And I said to myself, well, whoever said carbon fiber is exempt from something, and now it's a metal fatigue, something that drops. And I since have confirmed that. One of my personal experts said, I've come across that. Carbon fiber definitely has problems with delamination under excessive pressure cycles. So the answer was, yeah. Now we get to the other stuff you were saying. I found an interesting example. The fellow who basically made the famous Titanic movies about 20 years ago, James Cameron, he started going down in, you know, quality submersibles to see the Titanic while they were making the movie. And he became obsessed with the concept of submersibles. And he's become quite an expert in them. And I saw him interviewed. He gave a very good description, very, very good. He basically said that ever since I saw what his procedures and this and that and everything. Well, I was mortified. I told people I would go via that for anything. So there was a lot of stuff going around about how the whole thing was, and he was basically saying, you know, the government overregulates. Well, he just proved the government doesn't overregulate. Any comments, Roy?
No, I agree with you entirely. In addition to all this, as time goes on, you hear more and more stupid things he did. You know, his carbon fiber material, he bought it from Boeing. They apparently sold it to him because it had gone past its due date. So they were selling it at a loss. So he cut a little corner by buying steel carbon fiber, whatever that impacts the durability. So, every day you learn another stupid thing that this guy did. It's almost like someone should really think about whether they could kind of raise him from the dead just so that they could kill him again.
You want to hear my story about it was before?
Yeah, sure.
In airplanes, many, many parts a manufacturer are stamped with a used bike. A number of years ago, there was a small plane crash on the grounds behind Syosset High School. And I'm surprised I don't recall it, because my kids went to Syosset High School, and it certainly was within a tenure of living in the Syosset School District. But a small plane crash in Syosset, and while it was not a true single-point failure, actual single-point failure that actually caused the crash, but could have been averted, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if you come down to the one thing that broke, it was a vacuum pump in the navigational system that was well past its use-by date. So there's your answer.
Yeah, it's a shame for the family of the people who died. There was two guys, a father and son. Apparently, one had given the other kind of a present. They dropped $500,000 to die in a very historic place, right next to the Titanic. It's a terrible, terrible story.
Well, there are other stories of that kind of nonsense. Deepwater Horizon, Boeing 737 MAX 8 have a lot of the same attitude.
Well, yeah, I mean, hubris is the thing that kind of ran Greek tragedies 2,500 years ago. So hubris is still alive and well, and in the sick psyche of many a guy who thinks he's far more clever than he really is.
And you do realize what the ultimate example of that culture is.
What would that be, Ed?
RMS Titanic.
Well, yeah, I mean, people have been running parallels for the last few days about the Titan and the Titanic. And that, you know, the Titan was as doomed as the Titanic was, so principally the same problem, hubris, you know, the unsinkable Titanic.
That was only the start. There was a lot more to it than that. How about going at maximum speed through icebergs without sufficient lookouts?
Yeah, it was a lot of stupid things. Did anyone ever prove that the captain was a drunk, or that was just supposition on some people's part?
A, I never heard that one. B, Exxon Valdez, Joseph Hazelwood, both of boys named Good, became the world's youngest super taxi captain flying drunk. So was any surprise that his fall from grace was when he was blind drunk?
Yeah, I mean, there are some situations in life where you can pretty much see it like it's in your rear view mirror. There's a car. I had a car accident that way, where I was sitting there on a red light, looking in the rear view mirror as a car didn't slow down as it reached me. You know, it's just, there's so many versions of that in real life, unfortunately.
My son was once in a similar accident, but he got hit on the second bounce.
Yeah, I mean, I was fortunate. The intersection wasn't terribly busy, and I decided on some kind of compromise between brake and roll into traffic. And his was an old jalopy that apparently didn't have a heck of a lot of momentum behind it. So everything, except the rear end of my car, survived reasonably well. But it gave me a good analogy for life, at least.
You always learn.
Well, I mean, that's how I close every technical match. Keep an open mind, try to learn something new every day.
Want to hear what I learned today?
Okay.
Dummy loads fail.
Okay, I never thought that they didn't fail, but there's lots of different ways that a dummy load could fail. I used to read lots of people complaining that their oil cans inevitably leaked all over the damn place.
No, I'm not talking about an oil filled one. No, it's field day today. I was at field day yesterday and decided, based on some nonsense I won't bore you with, let me bring my rig today for a strong finish. So I'm setting it up, and these are just plain weird. I have a little dummy load. It's, you know, I'm running it. It's a 25-watt little screw-on dummy load. I'm putting 100 watts into it for a couple of seconds, and it's like, I can't get a dummy load to load to my antenna tuner. And it turns out it was the dummy load opened up.
Well, I mean, ultimately, it's just a resistor. Resistors have been known to fail. They open, they short, they do all kinds of fun stuff.
KG2RY?
Yes, David.
Good evening, gentlemen. I wasn't here in the beginning of the TechNet. I was wondering if you had anybody talk about the field day experiences yesterday, earlier today.
Well, I mean, we had Glenn N2ZAE mention that he was at field day, but no one's really extolled their day, and it's coming time for our SpaceNet report. So if you want, we could ask around for next Sunday if anyone wants to tell us how this Sunday went.
It's really quick to ask you to answer any questions.
Okay. Hopefully Paul doesn't mind.
QSL, no problem. Have a great night. Stay positive.
Okay, well, I think we've kind of done it for tonight. I don't want to take any more of Paul's time for the SpaceNet report. Thank you very much, Ed. I appreciate, as always, your participation. I've missed you the last few months. I understand you're a busy guy. You don't have infinite amounts of time, but it's always a pleasure to chat with you.
I couldn't be here now, but I see this is too long.
Okay, well, I'm very thankful for that. That you gave us your time tonight. Anyway, this is AC2GS. I hope everyone enjoyed that. I did. And I hope you'll come back next Sunday when we try and do it all over again. But now it is time for full WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
Okay, thanks, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N. For the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And, field day. I didn't go over to the site. I stayed home. I worked One Delta and LI, so made a lot of CW contacts here for now. And talked about the problems with that submersible that went down. I was going to bring up a little bit of it that related to the space program. You know, I mean, first thing I heard of it was that, you know, maybe they were going to surface and they wouldn't be able to get out because they cannot get out from the inside. So apparently they didn't learn anything from the Apollo 1 fire on in 1967 when we lost three astronauts, Grissom, Chappie, and White. And White was the tallest one, and he was in the middle. And he tried like heck to open up the capsule from inside, and he couldn't do it. It just was a poor design, and it just didn't work out. And what happened, of course, was devastating. That fire, let me drop it. So even if these people did make it up to the surface, they wouldn't be able to actually open it. They need people on the outside to open it up for them, which I think is a poor design. I don't know if other ones are built like that. That sounds like a terrible idea. And then, of course, when they found out what really happened to them, they started talking more about the carbon fiber. And again, they should have taken a lesson from, for instance, SpaceX. SpaceX had a problem. It was a helium tank, and they wrap it. It's a metal tank, but they wrap it with this carbon fiber stuff, and they call it a composite overwrap pressure vessel seal. And it's a carbon fiber base. It's not anywhere near as thick as this thing, this contraption that they went down to see the Titanic. But still, the idea was there, and one of theirs blew up back in 2017. I remember covering that story on this net, and I went back and looked at that, and sure enough, they blew up on the launch pad. They were actually just testing. They were not getting ready for flight. They had this rocket on the launch pad. And then what they had was the expensive satellite was sitting on top. I think it was from Israel. And the whole thing blew up and wiped out Launch Complex 40. Completely took it out. And they spent next couple of years rebuilding that launch complex. Now, nobody was on board. Nobody got hurt. But they finally figured out that this composite overwrap pressure vessel, helium was... it was a helium tank, but the helium tank was inside of an oxygen tank. One tank inside of another. The oxygen tank was, down to, minus whatever it is, 273 degrees or something. It's the temperature, it almost turned to ice, oxygen ice, and they feel it got inside of it because they managed to duplicate the problem testing, after this disaster. Oh, okay. And anyway, the material eventually delaminated, and eventually the helium tank blew. Those things are super pressurized, and that pressure blew the oxygen tank. Ed, go ahead.
Just to be technically correct, you said minus 273. That minus 273 Celsius is absolute zero. So they probably were about 10, 15 degrees above that. Again, I agree with everything you said, just to be clear about the numbers.
Yeah, okay. I know he brings it down to such a low temperature, he calls it densification. And I forgot what the number was, but it used to be at one temperature, and then he said, let's bring it even colder and have it densified more, and this way we'll have more oxygen, compressed inside the rocket. So yeah, whatever the temperature was. They're all cryogenic temperatures, and nevertheless, you take something like that, and it delaminates, and... Now, there could be another problem, by the way, that they're talking about, which I could really see, is the flange set up between the best system is a cylinder. Previous ones are usually all cylinders, because that's actually stronger as you go down. that this thing was a tube with, you know, basically a cap on one end and a cap on the other end. Those caps were made of titanium. But now you match a titanium with, you know, on one side with a composite overwrap pressure vessel system on the other end, and you have a, to me, it's a mismatch of materials to begin with. And I wouldn't be surprised if they find a failure at that location as well. They talked about the glass. The glass is 7 inches thick, and it pushes tighter. You know, the seal actually pushes tighter with the higher pressure they go down. By the way, I think you said 7,000 feet. I think this thing was 12,000, roughly 12,500 feet down. And you can imagine the pressures. You know, pressures. I always said water was, I estimate that it's usually a half a pound per foot. But I know the real number is 0.43, and then salt water, of course, is a little different. Well, let's call it a half a pound per foot. You're looking at 5,000 psi down by the Titanic. Let me drop it.
A four minus direction.
Go ahead. Go ahead and back to you.
I didn't say the Titanic was down 7,000 feet. They were about halfway when it failed. So I'm estimating 7,000.
Really? I thought the information came out that they made it all the way down, and it was like right near, relatively near the bow of the sub, and they found it, you know, only, what, they said 1,500 feet away from the bow. So I'm assuming that they got down that low, and that's where it blew. But you're saying they had a problem at, you know, halfway down?
Yeah, possibly. No, they said that they had been descending for like 2.5 hours, and I think it's a 4-hour descent. And of course it was near the Titanic. Yeah, the pieces sank.
Understood. Okay. Yeah, I heard the trip was usually two hours down, 4 hours walking around, looking at this thing through one window, and then another couple of hours back up. And when they showed the pictures on the inside of this thing, I mean, it really did sound like the opposite of a good idea to get inside that thing. But, you know, what a shame. The only consolation is they probably didn't realize what was going on, or if they did, it was, you know, very shortly. And if you take something that drops down to that pressure, I remember just reading, because of this, oh, I don't know, 50, 60 years ago, they sent one of these things down without anybody in it. And I think they only went down to around 5,000 feet. And then they brought it back up, and the thing had developed a leak, and they didn't know it. So they went over to the submersible, you know, and they said the one guy was looking into it, and sure enough, it was filled with water. But he backed off from it. And they said that there was a little teeny pinhole, and water was shooting out of the thing. Because it had gone all the way down, now it's pressurized to, you know, thousands of PSI. And then when it came back up, the pressure's now inside this sphere. And eventually when they started to open it, they backed off away from it, and this whole door came flying off, and it went halfway across the mothership or something. And they said the guy's head would have gotten taken off if he was standing in front of it. Extremely dangerous at those pressures compared to outer space. Okay, let me just finish my one thought. Compared to outer space, where you go into, you're in a vacuum. You're trying to hold back no more than one atmosphere. And down there, they said it's 400 atmospheres. Yeah, head back to you.
Yeah, I believe spacecraft once, well, under an atmosphere to minimize that sort of stuff. You know, kind of like being up at 7,000, 8,000 feet is like, I think you're already at two-thirds of an atmosphere, like 10,000 feet. No, but what I want to say is, my take, and I spoke to other people, they agree with me, they literally did not know what happened. Stuff like that happened so fast that they probably were pulverized before the nerve impulse to what was going on in their brain.
Understood, yeah, what a shame. It's, that was a terrible story. You know, people were hoping for the best, but, you know, it turned out just terrible. And there's going to be, I'm sure, a lot of review of the equipment that was involved. They said that the robotic subs that are going down there or were down there are planning on bringing up pieces of this thing. So they're going to try to evaluate, to get an answer what happened. But I don't think anybody's going to be developing a composite overwrap pressure vessel system like this in the future. Anytime soon, anyway. Another report I heard was that, you know, because of salt water, that tends to get in there, into the air, wrapping a little bit. Like you said earlier, you go down and up a number of times before you know, after a while you're going to have fatigue. So, anyway, I thought I was going to cover that anyway. Let me just move on to a couple of different topics. While we have time, this is WS2N. I just want to mention in a month or so, well, I think around 6 weeks, there's going to be another SpaceX crew that's going to go to the International Space Station. And right now you have seven people up there. So when they go up, you'll have 11, and then four more will eventually come down. So it's a regular rotation, roughly every 6 months that they're doing this. And, you know, it's becoming commonplace where we practically don't even need to mention this anymore. But the reason I mention this one is because the commander of this flight is going to be Jasmine Marbell. And she's one of us from the island here. She comes out of Baldwin. And it'll be her first flight, and she's going to be the commander. And she's got a call sign too. KI5WSL. And, you know, she'll be, working in a free time. She'll be working stations from the amateur radio on board the station from Ares, amateur radio on the International Space Station. So she'll be the commander, and then three other people going with her. One fellow from Russia. Yes, from Russia. We're still dealing with Russian space. And the pilot's going to be Morgenstein, European Space Agency, and another fellow from Japan. So I thought that would be pretty good to watch. They're doing a... I think this is going to be like the ninth crew flight to the space station by SpaceX. So, the numbers are starting to add up. And good luck to them. Let me just move on to one other topic, unless somebody has a comment. Yeah, okay. Another SpaceX Falcon 9 lifted off a week or so ago without a crew, and their goal was to put this rideshare system into orbit. Rideshare is a new system developed by a company called Launcher, and this rideshare is that you hook up multiple satellites, sometimes dozens of them. Anyway, they launch this thing, and for some reason that system not able to function properly. It wasn't able to release the satellites. So I'm still trying to figure out if it was SpaceX problem or a combination of both. Sometimes they have problems when they separate the second stage, you know, the payload. I'm not sure exactly what went wrong, or it could be just a problem with the rideshare new system that they were using. But anyway, whoever has satellites on board this thing, sometimes there's a lot of CubeSats involved, and I guess we'll have to contact the insurance companies and try again in the future. Let me drop it. I mentioned SpaceX before with the new crew going up. Starliner was still trying to do this. Starliner is being made by Boeing, and they're trying to send their first crew up to the space station for a couple of years now. They've had a series of problems over the years that I've talked about here, trying to get to the space station, computer problems with Starliner not knowing where it is in space. Because of that, it was using too much fuel to try to get to where it thought it was supposed to be. And they realized it was bad programming from the start. But that caused problems. That was the first unmanned flight up to the International Space Station. Not enough fuel to get there, but they successfully came back and landed on land like they're supposed to. SpaceX lands there, Dragon in the water, splashdown, and Starliner lands in New Mexico. These big airbags on the bottom, three chutes that open up, airbags open up at the very bottom, and that's how they're going to land. And that worked fine. But now they decided to try it again, a year or so later, and they made it up to the International Space Station, again without a crew. And this test went very, very well. Docked to the space station, everything was fine. And then they returned. And, everything was going to be good for a crew in the future. Now they're looking into other problems. Turns out they have problems with the parachutes. They have little links that aren't as strong as they're supposed to be. In case one parachute fails, then they have two parachutes. It's designed to make it safe all the way down to New Mexico with the two parachutes. The problem is the links that they're using. They realize they're not as strong as they should be. If a two parachute system is used, you know, naturally going to have more strain on it. So that's creating delays. They also discovered wiring problems. You know, throughout the craft, they cover wires with tape. You know, this special tape is, it's supposed to be heat resistant, and the main purpose of it is, let's say, if you bang into it, you don't create a ding, you don't create a short, possible problem. They're realizing that this stuff is not as fireproof as they thought, and now they're thinking about, redoing the tape on, countless feet of wires that are inside Starliner. So that's going to be a problem. They're working on that. They were supposed to go up another month to the space station with the first crew. It's going to be two people in the beginning. But then that's successful. They'll stay for a couple of weeks. The Starliner could be put into rotation with SpaceX Dragon. Again, each flight would handle four astronauts to and from the International Space Station, and a 6-month period of time. So we'll see how that eventually works out. This is WS2N. SpaceX is very successful with launching one rocket after the other. It's up to 45 rockets now. And so, only half a year in. So they're just doing terrific as far as the amount of rockets that are going up. They've been competing right from the beginning with NASA rockets. NASA had a bunch of rockets. They have the Delta II, now retired. The Atlas V, which was eventually retired, still using that. And the Delta IV. Delta IV just sets up the second to last mission of that Delta IV will be doing. Delta IV, Delta IV, Delta IV Heavy. Delta IV is retired. But the Heavy, that's three of these things bolted together. And it creates about as much, a little bit more thrust than the Falcon 9 Heavy. Not correction, Falcon 9 itself. So you have probably 2 million pounds of thrust on the Delta IV Heavy. But it was successful. All their flights, all the Delta Four Heavy flights have really been successful. They don't send as many as what SpaceX is doing, but when they go up, they're pretty solid. And the same holds true for the Atlas V. Again, these are all NASA rockets, usually built. The Delta was always built by Lockheed, and then the Atlas was Boeing, and then they eventually combined back in 2007 to become the ULA, United Launch Alliance, which is really the two companies now responsible for these rockets. And eventually they will be replaced, all these rockets now, including the very successful Atlas V rocket, which will eventually be sending Starliner up. It's going to be replaced by Vulcan. Vulcan is under development. They've had it out of the launch pad. They've already tested the engines. They lit them off for 8 to 10 seconds or so, make sure everything works. Blue Origin engines on the bottom of that thing, and creating again probably a 1.5 million pounds of thrust. The Vulcan, they'll be able to use strap-on boosters. They'll be able to use 2, 4, even 6, more than what the Atlas V used to do. And when they start using the strap-on solid boosters, they're going to be able to get as much thrust as the Delta IV Heavy that just went up. Any comments? WS2I. Last thing I wanted to talk about was the Starship project by SpaceX. A few months ago, they launched the first one, and that's the one where it just ripped the launch complex apart, and they're still presently rebuilding it. Created a gigantic crater underneath where the rocket was. This thing that is the biggest, this is the most thrust of any rocket that ever successfully got off the launch pad. And all the engines weren't even firing. They were supposed to be 33 engines. But anyway, it got to the point where it was supposed to eventually separate from the second stage. The second stage would have been called the Starship itself, which would have gone into potential orbit. It was never planned to go into orbit. They planned on just going around the Earth and coming back down in Hawaii for this first test. But it never made it that far. When it separated, tried to separate, it didn't go well. Now Elon Musk just decided at a late date to change the system. What happens is the first stage, the heavy, they call it the Starship Heavy, gets up to a height of the 60 miles. At that point, it separates from Starship. What happens is their 33 engines are supposed to shut down, and then two pieces are supposed to separate, and then the 7 engines of the Starship will ignite to continue on. Now they realize that, well, this is going to create such a jolt. I mean, they've known this with, for instance, the Apollo mission. There's a big jolt when they have separation. And why is that? Because the engine completely shuts down, and it's an instant loss of thrust. And then the next stage comes on, and they get pushed back on the seats again. To eliminate that, I mean, it's a good idea to eliminate that, or to make it not as severe, they want to have hot staging. This has all got to be put in within the next 2 months, you know, to make this all work. Hot staging is a system where they have two stages going up, like you do with Starship. The first stage, before it shuts down, you know, it's going to be almost out of fuel. Before it shuts down, it's still firing, still creating thrust. Second stage ignites when it's still attached to it. And then at that point, then they separate. So now you don't have that terrible jolt. You're going to have a smoother transition from one stage to another. Now, you know, it's been done before. Russia, does that with their rockets. They have a hot staging system. And you can tell, and if you look at a Soyuz rocket before it goes up, it looks like there's these triangular truss pieces connecting the stages. And if you look real careful and there's a cloud behind it, you can actually see, through it from one end to the other, before they launch. And that's their system. I'm not sure what Elon Musk is going to do. I'm not sure how he's going to handle that. When it's ignites, how do you make sure that, you don't ignite or create an explosion in the lower stage as it separates? Anyway, to be continued, we'll see what happens when this thing eventually goes up. He's looking for another okay from the FAA. After the last catastrophe, including the flight termination system that was supposed to explode, was delayed, and eventually they were able to get that thing to ignite. They have some problems to work out before the FAA gives them an approval. But we'll see. Said it before, that's the way this guy tests. He launches rockets. If it blows up, well, now we'll fix it. Sounds good, especially if you have enough money to launch another one. But if NASA did that, like they go, all right, if the bulb goes up and there's a problem, maybe if something blows, maybe they could live with that. But the second flight better make it, otherwise Congress is going to get together. They're going to say, what are we paying you for? To blow up rockets, nothing would ever make it to orbit. So that's why NASA, when they launch rockets, and like I talked about, the success of the Delta II, the Delta IV, Delta IV Heavy, and Atlas V, very successful rockets. And they try every which way they can to have successful launches. Any comments? This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And Roy, it looks like I went a little over, but that's okay. What are you going to do? Hope everybody had a good field day, and the weather was really tough. High humidity and all, but hopefully next year will be a good field day as well. Before you know it, 1 year will be gone. Back to you, Roy, AT2GS. WS2N for the Space Network report for the TechNet.
Geez, don't push time, Paul. It pushes itself fast enough. I want to thank Paul for the SpaceNet report. Thanks for all you do here on the Technical Net, all that you do for the club. And we all appreciate it. I especially appreciate it. I also appreciate everyone who participated tonight. I think we had another fun night. I think some of us learned some things and had some fun. I hope to do it all over again next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when I return with another episode. As is the usual thing, a few quotes to leave by. Quotes from Dick, H-R-I-W, Silas T, who ran this net for 40-odd years. Be kind to each other. It's always good advice, so please keep it in mind. A line from Epictetus: it's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So don't suffer hubris like people who have suffered it and paid the price. Have an open mind. Learn something new every day if you can. Well, our rebels now are done. I wish you all a good week, and please come back. This is AC2GS, and formally closing this episode of the Limelight Technical Net, and Slava Ukraine.
I didn't hear Frank in there tonight, Roy. Hope we're going to get a report on the freeway that collapsed on I-95. I guess not. WS2N, we'll be clear.
Frank is on the Echo Link, so Frank, if you want to say hello to Paul, feel free.